Good morning, everybody. Okay, so we're embarking upon a new sugya. We spent Baruch Hashem so much time in the past sugya discussing issues related to robe and issues related to kavua, and of course we've all gone back to that famous scenario of the three salamis, the two kosher ones and the one trefa one. And the truth is that the Mishnah really spoke about that case. They didn't speak quite exactly about salamis, but the Mishnah really spoke about two different scenarios of potential applications of bittul berov. One was the scenario of a whole bunch of gidim that were mixed up together. One of the gidim was a gidam Moshe, and the others were permissible gidim. One of the Mishnah spoke about chatichos, that one of the chatichos was chatichos nevela, I guess the equivalent of a trefa salami, that could mix into other chatichos of kosher meat. So we're getting all ready for what the Mishnah is going to tell us about this. After all, we've been spending the last 8 months talking about rov, and we're pretty sure that we're about to see a real live application of bittul berov, and we're a little bit disappointed because the Mishnah doesn't tell us anything like that. In fact, it tells us the opposite. The Mishnah tells us if you have one gid mixed into multiple gidim, or one gid anoshim mixed into multiple gidim, or one chatichas nevela mixed into multiple chatichas of ksheiros, the Mishnah says if you can't tell which is which, kulan asuros. They're all prohibited, which is, in a certain sense, flies in the face of everything we've been talking about, definitely for the last few weeks, and in a certain sense, for the last couple of months. So what happened to bittul berov? So we shouldn't be too concerned, because that's the Gemara's question. And in fact, from the fact that the Gemara asked the question so blatantly, so obviously, that what happened to bittul berov, it's exactly from that question of the Gemara that led us down the path of believing that rov is very, very effective. That Chazal couldn't believe the Mishnah. You have a rabbi throw their hands and says, "What's going on in the Mishnah?" Let's take a look at the first of the Mamakadlos. The Gid Anoshe Shemiz Basho. Yes, the Gemara of Lifta Baruba. What do you mean? It'll be Bafla Barov. On the Gemara, there are no marks, no pronouns, no question marks, no exclamation points, etc. But in the Bar Ilan, so you have your marks. So if I was writing the Bible, I would have put a question mark and not an exclamation point. There's a question. The lift of the Ruba, what are you talking about? What is the Mishnah talking about? How can the Mishnah dare say that the Gid Anoshe asks all the other Gidim, let it be the lift of the Ruba? So answers the Gemara, you're right. That basically Rove carries the day. And we shouldn't have Chalish Sadas. Everything we've been learning about for the last 8 months is true. Pitzel Barov is Givaldic, and maybe it's even a Sinebach Lios Heter. And according to some Rishonim, you can even eat all three. And there's no problems with Kavua. Rove is great, Rove is Givaldic, Rove is wonderful. But there's a problem here. And there's a very, very technical consideration here. There was a quirk that's going on in the Mishnah. There is a reason why the Gid Anoshe is not Bothel. And that reason is one word. The word is Beria. That's the answer to the Gemara. After the exclamation point comes the answer, Beria Shiny. Now, what exactly does that term mean? Not only do I not yet know what the term means, I don't even know how to pronounce it. I just pronounce it like the Yeshiva Shemai Beria. It could be the correct pronunciation, maybe Beria. I have no idea. I'm not sure what the correct pronunciation is, but we'll pronounce it the way it's pronounced in the Olam Yeshiva. It's a Beria. It's not Beria. It's a Din Beria. So what does that mean? So what the Gemara is clearly telling us is that there is something about Gid Anoshe that doesn't lend itself to the regular rules of Bittul. The Gemara is going to ask a similar question in the next sugya. What about the case of Chatichas Nevela? And the Gemara is going to come up with a similar but slightly different teretz as to what unique characteristic Chatichas Nevela has that doesn't lend itself to Bittul. We're going to hold off on that for a little while. That'll probably have to shavuos in the next sugya. Right now, we have to focus on this answer, the Gemara. Beria Shiny, there is something about a beria that doesn't lend itself to the regular rules of bittul. And the question is, what in the world is a beria? And why is there a concept of a beria? Where does it come from? What is the source? And why is this so troubling in terms of applying the regular rules of bittul? So the word of beria definitely seems to be related to something about the bara, beria, a creature, an entire being. So basically what a beria means in a very, very broad sense is that it is an entire unit, it is an entire creature, so to speak. It is a halakhically recognized unit in and of itself, and that grants it a certain degree of chashivos. The fact that it is whole, it is intact, and it is an entire a halakhically accepted unit, distinct from other things, that grants it a certain degree of significance, and that spells trouble for the parish of Bittel. We've said this time and time again, that the whole institution of Bittel is declaring that the item is insignificant. The item has lost its characteristics. It's very hard for us to apply Bittel with a straight face when there is a halakhic consideration of the item being actually significant, actually being very important, actually being something that is, in a sense, a davar chashuv, it is important and it is significant, and therefore, bittul will not be effective under these circumstances. So the idea of bittul, although we haven't quite defined it, we haven't even begun, not even quite, we haven't all begun to define what does constitute such a category. We definitely know the direction that we're going in. We're trying to isolate this gid anosh and say, this gid anosh is not subject to the regular rules of bittul because it has some degree of chashivas to it. And that degree of chashivas is expressing itself through the halakhic principle called averia. So we have to ask ourselves many, many questions to understand the sugya. We have to ask ourselves one of the basic questions that you always ask, are we dealing with the din d'oraisa, are we dealing with the din d'rabbanan? How exactly do you define averia? How would you know whether you have a given beria on hand? There happen to be other areas of halakha where the term beria applies, and are those other areas of halakha important? Are they relevant? Do they shed some light on some of the mystery behind this halakha beria? So we have a lot of work to do just to get a little bit of a sense as to what is going on. So let's start with the second of the Mamakamas, the Ritva, on the Sugyan Chulav Kufam and Aleph, where the Ritva begins to give you some kind of insight to some of the issues that are troubling us. So says the Ritva, Prakina Beria Shani, Perish. Gina Nosha burial. Gina Nosha is an entire unit. The Koshu burial, whatever is an entire unit, Kishem Shechoshuv Leinyan Malkus, Shalokin Allah Bekoshu, Kachoshuv Leinyan Isser, Sheosu Bekoshu Lemina. So in one fell swoop, in one half line, the Ritva just made a reference to the halacha burial that appears in slightly other areas of halacha, and it's just invoked a model that's going to become critical for us. Comes the Ritva and tells us this is not the first time we've ever bumped into the sugya beria. If we go back to sugyas in Maseches Makos, remember many years ago, as kids, I always joke with my Tamidim that the first blot in Maseches Makos has probably been learned by every single child who ever went through camp about 15 summers in a row. When I was a kid, so we had learning groups. We got a little bit older, so learning group, we began to learn Gemara, and you always started with Maseches Machos. The theory, I think, always was, it's short, only 24 blot, and we can finish it in the summer. We never got anywhere past the base. It may have had to do with, not so much with the quality of the Rebbeim, but as to the inability of some of the younger Talmidim, myself included, to sit still for more than 10 minutes. But we would always start at the base. It was Ketz Eidim Nasim Zomim. Every summer we'd begin with Ketz Eidim Nasim Zomim. And we'd learn the first couple of lines, and maybe we'd make it to the base of the base. And then the summer would come to an end. And then the next summer, so the same theory began. We'll start to try to tackle Maseches Machos. I remember the time I was in eighth grade, I learned the first Daf of Machos about six times. But we never made it to Daf Gimel. I used to always say that the reason why I think we never made it to Daf Gimel was, those who remember Maseches Machos, it was a very, very difficult sugya. Daf Gimel and Daf Machos, one of the hardest sugyas in Shas. By Ketet Shaman, Isha, Ish, Ksuba, complicated mathematical equation, and I think the council just didn't have the cheshek or the ability maybe to try to transmit that sugya to a bunch of rowdy 8-year-olds. So we just kept on chasing over Ketet Eitz and Masa Zomim time and time again. But if you would actually ever make it to the end of Maseches Machos, so a Mishnah, the third Bechel Machos, you would bump into the following, that the Mishnah talks about how much must a person eat of non-kosher food in order to be liable with the punishment of Makos. And we know that there are shiurim, there's halacha Moshe Mesinai, what's considered to be a shir achila for the purposes of onshin. True, we pass in chati shir osim in the Torah, but in terms of onshin, in terms of meeting out punishment, so there is a shir, and the shir is a kedayis. Comes the Mishnah and says that there's an exception to that rule. Of ochel memola, if a person eats an entire ant, or any other kind of an entire bug, even though that bug is significantly less than a kedayis, one is Chaya Malkus, one violated in full force the Issa D'Oraisa of Achila, that is considered to be a Chi of Malkus. Why is that? Where does that come from? So clearly what that halacha is telling us is that what you are missing in terms of quantity, you are making up in terms of quality. Even though it is true that you don't have the quantity of a Kedayis, But since you have qualitatively something significant, you have an entire item. This is not like taking half a spoonful of chazer meat, but rather you're eating an entire bug. So even though it's well short of a kezias, you're going to be chayim malchus. There is no question that that is a din in the Torah. We do not give malchus deraisa. This is not malchus marius. This is malchus deraisa. We do not give malchus deraisa unless the violation was mideraisa. And therefore, the Gemara, in effect, is telling us that there is a halachic principle min haTorah called beria. Beria is considered to be a davar chashuv on a level of deraisa, with nafkaminas in the realm of malchus. Comes the Ritva and now connects the dots and says, well, if beria is chashuv vis-a-vis malchus, that you receive malchus even though you didn't eat all that much, you ate actually merely a kol shehu, it is similarly chashuv vis-a-vis isurim. And therefore, if you have a piece of a small piece of chaz and it falls into a bat, we can apply the principles of rov. But if you have an entire gidanosha, which halachically is called a beria, if that gets mixed up with other gidanoshas, you cannot ignore, you cannot declare it to be batel, because as the Ritva says, kishem shechoshel lidin malchus, kachoshel lidin nisur, she'osu v'kol shu. That is the equation of the Ritva. The Ritva is the first one that I know of who makes the link very, very clear that the din of beria is based and is patterned and is similar to the halacha of beria in terms of chiyuv malchus. However, what is not clear is, even naniach, that this equation, so to speak, is correct, did the Ritva mean to say this is a din min haTorah? That min haTorah, a beria is not batel? Because min haTorah, a beria is too chashuv to lend itself to bittel on a level of deraisa? Just as it's too chashuv to lend itself to the requirement of a shir kezayis min haTorah, did the Ritva mean to equate the two sigyas? Or did the Ritva mean simply to say that on the level of the Rabbanim, when Chazal were evaluating, should we as Rabbanim permit us to rely on the dinim deraisa bittel? Chazal were very, very weary to apply bittel when there's a davar chashuv here. We've seen this many time and time again. And how exactly you define it as something as a davar chashuv is very, very tricky. Maybe this is one of the criteria that Chazal used to define a davar chashuv. That just as in Maseches Makos, the beria is considered to be a davar chashuv vis-a-vis malchus, unless it is kezayis. So too, vis-a-vis bittel, the isurin, bittel merov, of chul, of kof, we midrabanan, not the Torah, but we midrabanan will not allow you to rely on bittel because this smacks of a davar chashuv. And if you want to know how do you define davar chashuv, ayin sham in Maseches Makos, that beria is a way of defining davar chashuv. But the application of that principle to Hilchos Tarovos is only midrabanan. So now we have a real shaila in front of us. What is the din? Are we dealing with the sugya d'oraisa, beria being a meneya, being something that is preventing bittel min haTorah, or is this entire sugya only a sugya midrabanan? So my nafkamina, what's the difference? At the end of the day, we are bound by the Mishnah, bound by the Gemara's conclusion. Shulchan Aruch, beria appears. Why do we care whether we're dealing with a din d'oraisa or a din d'rabanan? So as we always know, the best test case, whether something is d'oraisa or d'rabanan, what would the din be vis-a-vis sfeikos? What would the halacha be if you have a situation where we're not even sure we have a beria on our hands? Are we dealing with a beria? Maybe yes and maybe no. So once again, if we're dealing with a din d'oraisa, potential d'oraisa, we would have to err on the side of caution. If we're dealing with something which is only midrabanan anyway, then we would clearly have a right to be a little bit more lenient, maybe suffering d'rabanan l'kula. So what is the din? So is there a case of a suffering beria? Does that case even exist? So the Ritva continues in the next paragraph of that Maramakom. And the Ritva makes reference to a sugya in Maseches Nazir. The Gemara actually raises a technical detail, a little bit of not the most appetizing sugya, but the Ritva makes reference to a sugya in Maseches Nazir in the second of Maramakom, the second paragraph. Uberia shenechtecha mimena eiver shenishama tluyaba pshitad lo chashe beria. What if I have a beria? Let's say I have a bug, for example, or a very, very small other kind of a creature, and part of that bug, part of the creature, has a limb removed. So does a simple mere removal of one small limb, does that automatically cancel its beria status? Is that mevatel the status of a beria? So it is obvious, as the Ritva, we learned the sugyas in Nosadaf the Malach of Amaze, that if the limb that is missing is an Eimesh and Hashem Atluyaba, it's a type of a limb that the creature cannot live without, that is clearly would undermine its status as a beria. Let's say, for example, if I have a bug and I cut off the head of the bug and I eat the rest of the bug, that cannot be called a beria. A bug missing a head will not be able to survive, And therefore, that for sure will impact on its status of burial. But what about what about a bug that's missing something that it doesn't depend upon for life? And again, I'm not exactly a, you know what they call them, experts in bugs, bug doctors, whatever you want to call them. But if you have a fly that's missing, I imagine there are parts of a fly's body that if it's missing, the fly will still survive. It's ain anashe b'tluyaba. Would you call that still a barrier or not? That's kamina midaraisa and gimalkas. So bazuyesh nishtap, listapik, shemlo bota chashibuso. He says, we're not sure. Does that detract from its barrier status or not? Vis-a-vis Malkus and Maseches Nazir, the Gemara is not sure. So maybe we should take the attitude, well, we don't know whether this particular item is still called the barrier. And therefore, vis-a-vis Bittel Isurim, not Malkus, vis-a-vis Bittel Isurim, we would have to be Machmir perhaps. But the Ritva quotes the name of the Ramban. The Ramban was the Ritva's Rebbe's Rebbe. Well, was the Talmud Muvuk of the Ra'ah, Rabban Malevi, who for many years people thought wrote the Sefer Chinuch, then they realized probably didn't. The Ra'ah was the Talmud Muvuk of the Ramban. So the Ritva was two generations away from the Ramban. So the Ramban says that the Kevada Yisura de Rabbananu, the entire issue here of Beria vis-a-vis Bittel, the Rov, is only Midr Rabbanan. The Midr Raisa Beria Bittel Kishar Yisura. Midr Torah says the Ritva, there is nothing to talk about. There is no problem. Minatura whatsoever. Hashtu besveken akin in the kula. Therefore, since the issue of Beria is not being bottled, I didn't say Beria is not getting malchus or getting malchus, I said Beria is not being bottled. Schulend of kuf is only midirabana. Minatura barriers are identical to anything else. Therefore, if a limb which didn't delight to the animal or the bug or the small bird, whatever it is, doesn't depend upon anyway, would be cut off. That could potentially, we would be comfortable to say, when we suffix, that's not called a barrier anymore. And suffix, the chumra barrier being a derabanan, suffix, derabanan, the kula. So this is almost like an example we spoke about a little bit last that year. Those were with us last that year. We were talking about the sugya and sefkas menachas, about the doctor who prescribes two figs on Shabbos. And now the question becomes, should I cut off the two figs from two separate branches, or should I cut off one branch which has the extra third fig on it? We said that even though the example itself is probably never happening, never will happen, but Baruch Hashem for that example, for Rava's creative mind to create that example, for us to be able to identify issues of Yishurin and Chulia Nutra and so many important sugyas that emanated from that somewhat the strange scenario. So to over here, we give a course of Tov to Chazal and Nozad Daftanah for Beis to come up creatively with the following scenario. I have a bug and part of the bug has been removed. But the part of the bug has been assured to us that it's not something that will impact on the life of the bug. And now the person eats that half, I couldn't say half, but that partially mutilated bug. Is he chayim malchus or not? When was the last time that happened? Probably never. When is the next time it's going to happen? We hope never, never again. Although a little bit of a humorous aside, last winter, so I took my younger daughter to Florida for a couple of days during my winter break. It happened to be once in 20 years that happened to be that YU and the other schools happened to just coincide on winter break, a little bit of a fluke in the calendar. So I took her down to Florida for a couple of days. So I took her to, one day we went to the South Florida State Fair. So one of the fascinating booths at the South Florida State Fair was insect eating. There was a whole array of sugared insects and roasted insects and chocolate insects and all different boots available for the partaking of insects. So needless to say, it was a fascinating. Some, not that the bugs were tasty, I didn't say that, but the idea was rather fascinating. I tried so hard to fulfill what the Gemara says in the Sefer Makos, that when you see tray for food, you're supposed to say, I really want to eat it. I'd love that cheeseburger, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu said not to. You're not supposed to say, ugh, I can't stand it. It gets me nauseous. It gets me sick to eat a cheeseburger. So I was trying really hard to stand there. I figured this is the only time to fulfill this mitzvah, vis-a-vis Shratzim. And I was saying to myself, wow, that chocolate-covered ant and that sugar-coated beetle, they look phenomenal. I can't wait to have that for dessert. Oh, Baruch Hashem, I remember there's a Pasuk in Chumash that says I'm not allowed to do that. I tried hard. I may have been faking myself out a little bit because my stomach was churning as I was looking at some of those things. But it was, again, an interesting thing. So people still do me bugs. I did not have the heart to ask somebody there to try to take off one of the legs, which is Eilat Hashemot Liyabel, so I can analyze the Sugya Nazir in a real live scenario, whether it would be Malchus. So yes, the case probably never happened, but the principles behind the case are critical, because it's Dafka that Gemara that led to Rishonim here to address the issue, are we dealing with the Derais, are we dealing with the Derabbanan? And that's going to make all the difference in the world. Because as we begin to, the sugya begins to unfold about barriers, we're going to see that there are many, many cases where barrier does come up in very real shadows from Isa. We happen to have many, many, we'd be shocked at how many times shadows of barrier come up from Isa for us, particularly in the realm of insects. We'll talk about it as we go on a little bit more later on in the sugya, but many, many shadows come up in the terms of vegetables and fruits and other foods that have potential infestation problems. And the question becomes, that if those kinds of foods are cooked into other foods and the bug, so to speak, may become batel, can we say that it's batel? Can we apply bittel to barriers? Are the barriers intact? Are they not intact? How exactly do you define intact? How are we dealing with the derais think about the derabbanan think problem? What's the view on what's called intact? I've had the special privilege to be sitting together with mashkichim and trying to set policy. We're looking at looking at bugs, and sitting around and analyzing bugs in quinoa, sitting around analyzing bugs in bags of rice, and assorted kinds of bug shilas. And sometimes part of the issues revolve around how do you define what exactly an entire barrier is. Sometimes part of the barriers are not fully intact anymore. How do you label intact? What is called a barrier? How do you define it? Is it to the naked eye? To define barrierness, you have to look at it a little bit more carefully. Is it the expert's eye? Is it the layman's eye? A lot of interesting issues that go into define what a barrier is, what a barrier is not. And those impact kashrus in the year 2020. There's no question about that. Many, many, many issues that kashrus come up in terms of relating to the issues of barrier. So barrier is a very real sugya. The particulars of nazir are probably not so relevant, but the sugya of barrier is critical. And the first question that behooves us to answer is, are we dealing with the deraisas here? Can we be comfortable to say that worst case scenario, we're only dealing with the rabbanans anyway? So according to the Ritva, we're only dealing with the rabbanans, notwithstanding the fact that the root of the din is a deraisa, the source of the din is deraisa, the concept of barriers is deraisa, but the application of barrier out of the realm of Malchus into the realm of Tarovas is only with the rabbanan. However, notwithstanding the Ritva's conclusion in the name of the Ramban, that we're only dealing with the Derabbanan, we have reason to believe that not all Rishonim agree to this. We have reason to believe that there may be an actual Deraisa that is taking place here, at least according to some things in Rishonim. The Rishonim do not say it absolutely explicitly. We have to put together pieces a little bit. We have to look at certain Gemaras through the eyes of certain Rishonim, and we'll come to the conclusion that it is clear, although not stated explicitly, that some Rishonim were of the opinion that barrier is not something that's merely the Rabbanan, it is something we have to reckon with potentially on a level of the Raisa. So one of those Rishonim is a Tosus. It's a Tosus of all places, nowhere near Maseches Chulin. It's a Tosus in Maseches Bavitzia. It's almost from a comment, from an assumption that Tosus makes that leads us to believe that Tosus disagrees with the Ritva. In order to appreciate the Tosus, we have to go back to the Sugya for a moment. Those who have been with us on what used to be the Motzei Shabbos Shiurim the last couple of weeks, last week was the Thursday night Shiur, but that whole series of Shiurim we gave about Tzvirus Omer, so we actually quoted this sugya, not because of Tosfos' part, but a totally different part of this sugya that is now going to repeat itself for our purposes. We'll just quickly learn through the sugya again, just to get our bearings into the sugya, and then we'll be able to hopefully approach Tosfos. In the third of the Mamakamos, the Gemara quotes a Mishnah, Maseches Bechoros, Kofetz Echem Ramanum Sochin Kulub Turin. The Mishnah is talking about a scenario of a person trying to fulfill the mitzvah of Maisa Be'eva. So he's counting down the animals, and that's what brought us to the Sugya Sfiras Omer. It's another example where Sfira plays a role. It's actually interesting because the only case in the Chumash per se where the notion of a minyan exists and the number minyan is 10 happens to be animals, believe it or not. So the idea of Ein Dovish Pukedusha Pochos Me'asar is a din deraisa vis a vis other things that's a Rosh Pukedusha Mapeh and has implications of deraisa and the Rabbanan. Of course, it touches on the whole series of Davi and a minyan. But the original, so to speak, the only clear case in Tosh Mechsav with the notion of a minyan being 10 actually, believe it or not, is animals, not people. The menuyim for Maisa Behemah. That's why we spoke so much about the sugya vis-a-vis Shiras Omer. because once again, the Torah gives us a mitzvah of Sviras HaOmer. We spoke about Sviras Yovel and Sviras Shibakiyim and Svira Minyan to count the animals of Michaim. So a person has his barn, he's got his thousands of animals there, and he's counting off 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. The 10th animal, he makes a mark, puts it aside, and says, this is going to be the carbon. Then he's got 10,000 animals that have already passed through under the stick. Once they have passed under that stick, they've been counted. And once they've been labeled a 1 to 9 animal, they are done their history. They're never supposed to be counted again. Not only are they not supposed to be counted, they cannot be counted. And if they find their way back into the barn, that's going to throw off our entire count. So the farmer's got to be very careful when he does his mitzvah to keep everything in the right category. There are three different groups here. So you have the group of animals yet to be counted. They're in the barn. You have the other group of animals that have already been counted and were numbers 1 to 9 and a putter, and just going to be eating regular animals. And you have the third group that are going to be the number 10 animals that are actually going to eventually be brought to Shlaim as Kabanas. So the three groups have to be kept separate and distinct from one another. The last thing you want is the intermingling of the groups. So talk about social distancing at its best. You have to have the animals in their own groups, and there's no a term that you may be seeing very, very soon in many of your shuls, but cross-pollinization. So we don't want any crossing of any groups because the repercussions can be very, very difficult for us in terms of Hilchos Kabanos. So here, unfortunately, I don't want to give you many ideas, but unfortunately some of the animals didn't follow the rules. And by not following the rules, I guess we should give a course of toast to the animals that didn't follow the rules, because if not for that, we wouldn't have the sugi to talk about. The Sheikh Shmaitz wouldn't have pages and pages to write about. But that's what the Mishnah says, Kofetz Echem and Aminuyim. One of the animals from group C, whatever it is, the animals that were counted already, the 1 to 9 animals that were supposed to stay put in their own corner, one of them got a little homesick for its friends back behind in the barn and decided to jump back into the barn. And by doing so, just created havoc for us. Why? Because now I have another 1,000 animals left in the barn. Out of those 1,000 animals, 1,000 of them are still chayiv in my sedema, but now I have 1,001 animals left. Because Kofetz Echem Aminuyim. And one of those animals is not chayav in Ma'aseh Behemah anymore and can never be chayav in Ma'aseh Behemah anymore and can never be counted towards the subsequent counts of Ma'aseh Behemah. And now I'm in a real pickle, because how am I going to continue to count at this point? Because anytime I begin to count, there's a possibility that one of the animals that I'm going to be using in my next count, maybe one of the putter animals, which will invalidate my entire count, which in turn will invalidate my entire Ma'aseh Behemah. So there's absolutely no way of fulfilling my sebehema with all the subsequent animals until I can identify which is the pre-counted animal. The problem is I have no mechanism of doing that. I do not recognize one animal from another. Maybe one sheep can recognize another sheep, but I can't. And now I have one giant mixture, one giant tarobes of 1,001 animals. 1,000 of them are still technically chayv in my sebehema. One of them is not, and I have nothing I can do about it. The Mishnah says, kulon peturin, that they're all exempt, and farmer go home. You just lost out the opportunity to fulfill the mitzvah. Now, Ma'aseh Behemah, if you don't fulfill the mitzvah, it doesn't impact on the kashrus of the animals. It's not like Truman Ma'aseh, where if you don't separate Truman Ma'aseh, the food is tevel as asa. The animals are mutter to be eaten as regular chulin, but you unfortunately lost your opportunity to fulfill the mitzvah Ma'aseh Behemah on these remaining animals. So Tosfos on the 4th of the Ramakamos is bothered with the question. Tosfos says, wait a second. Why do we have to disqualify all the animals? Why don't we simply do as follows? Kema, the liftal beruba. Why don't we just say that one animal that's putter, let it be butl berov? Why is this fundamentally different than the three salamis? Let this one animal be butl berov. The lechayv akula b'maiser. Let's just say that we now have 1,001 animals that are chayv. And say that based on the principle of rov, we can even coin a phrase, issa nepach lios hefter, or in this case we can say, animal hapotter nepach lios chayev. And now we can just simply say we're all chayev, we're good to go. And why does the Mishnah say kulon peturin? The farmer gets off scot-free. Forget, let him be totally chayev based on bitul berov. So in order to offset that question, Tosfos is thinking for a moment that maybe bitul doesn't apply to this kind of a scenario. Maybe there's something about an animal that's walking around that doesn't lend itself to bitul. If that would be true, that the animal doesn't lend itself to bittul, then that would explain why bittul doesn't apply, what the Mishnah has to throw its hands up and say kulon peturin. But Tosfos is now frantically searching through all of Maseches Chulin for a reason why, maybe in our wildest dreams, why is any given animal not subject to bittul? If we can successfully find the reason why an animal is not subject to bittul, then the Mishnah makes perfect sense. So Tosus begins their quest. So they begin with almost a little bit of a humor. I can't say for certain whether Balat Tosus meant this a little bit of a joke, but it's possible they meant almost a little bit of a pun. Now, the Dover Shebeminyan Lobotil. There is a principle in Tarovus called Dover Shebeminyan. Dover Shebeminyan means things that are generally counted out, always counted out. We spoke a little bit about this in the past. If I have an item that's always counted, it's always sold by a specific number, that's not bittul. When I walk into a store and I want to buy an item, so do I say I want a pound of such and such, or do I want a very, very specific number of such and such? One of the interesting examples of a possible Dabashim B'minyan that we spoke a little bit about in the past are eggs. Are eggs something that are always counted out, sometimes counted out? I think in America, it's pretty clear people buy eggs by a number. You don't, when was the last time you walked into a store and said, I'd like to buy a bag full of eggs, please. You buy eggs, it's a dozen, or maybe two dozen, maybe a dozen and a half, 18 eggs. But nobody measures eggs in any other way in the world today, at least the world that we live in today, any other way rather than a number. Whereas in Europe, that wasn't always the case. I may have told this over in the past, but I was learning Yeridea, so my Chavrusa once walked into Seder, elated. He said that he was just the day before he had been walking down St. Nicholas Avenue and he noticed that there was a fellow on the corner who was selling a bag of eggs. And he just, for curiosity, he asked the fellow, how many eggs are in there? And the fellow said, I don't know, a bag of eggs, whatever he's selling, a bag of eggs, $1 for a bag of eggs. He wasn't even sure how many they're in. So he said, Baruch Hashem, somebody in this world considers eggs to be not a Dabashim B'minyan. That in reality, whether the standards of Dabashim B'minyan are defined by St. Nicholas Avenue in Washington Heights, I cannot tell you. But for the most of us, so eggs are Dabashim B'minyan today. So comes to us and says, maybe the reason why the animal is not batel is because it's a Dabashim B'minyan. It's always counted. I think what's a little bit of a humor, a little bit of a pun, is Ma'ase Behema is Dabashim B'minyan. That's what it is. You have to count it. That's exactly what you have to do. So an animal is a Dabashim B'minyan, Pshuta Kimashmo, Kol Sheyava Tachas Hashavet. So Tosa says, no, that's not going to solve the world's problems. You know why? Even though the Adadosh and the Bottle had a Midrabbanan, Tosa squashes the territory before you even get off the ground. Tosa says, that din of Dosh and the Bottle, everybody knows, that's only a Chumah Midrabbanan. The Mishnah is talking Deraisa. We're trying to figure out, is this fellow Chayav Minatar? My name is a Deraisa to get in, and therefore it follows the Deraisa to the standards of Bittel and non-Bittel. And therefore you cannot invoke a din Midrabbanan and tell me, well, since there's a din de rabbanon that Dabashim B'minyan is not batal, therefore that's why the animal is not batal. Difficult to turn. Wrong, says Tosfos. If Dabashim B'minyan would have been a din de raisa, then you would have had a leg to stand on. But since we all know, says Tosfos, Dabashim B'minyan is only a din rabbanon, therefore it's inconceivable that should be the reason why Bittul doesn't apply in the Mishnah, which is clearly relating a din de raisa. So up until now, Tosfos has not yet said the word barrier. Not yet, but right around the corner, Tosfos is about to raise in a moment the same possible answer that they attempted and failed with Dabashim B'minyan. They're going to chis amesim on the answer, but a little bit of a different format. They're about to apply the potential answer to the vehicle of barrier. And now we're going to be watching very, very carefully what Tosfos' response is. Is Tosfos going to just mach avet barrier and say that's also the Rabbanan and ignore the teretz? Or is Tosfos going to come up with a different teretz, leading us to believe that barrier is not so simple as the Rabbanan? So we're building our entire case on a diuk of Tosfos. We're building our entire theory that maybe somebody argues with the Ritva and claims barrier is a deraisa based on what Tosfos may or may not say. So we have to hopefully put this on hold till tomorrow to pick up the Tosfos. We're leaving off literally in the middle of the sentence, but we have to pick up Mitzvah tomorrow to figure out, is there any indication that Tosfos actually subscribes to the idea that barrier is a deraisa? And if it's true, what could that possibly be based on? And how does that impact on some other aspects of Bittul? And again, once we determine whether barrier is a deraisa derabanan, then hopefully we'll be free to ask the next major question, what is a barrier and what is not a barrier? How would you even know whether you have a barrier on your hands? And to figure out, when we say that barrier in a bottle, what does that really mean? Is that an absolute statement, chayk lo yavor? Or is there a certain wiggle room, certain exceptions to the rule, even if something does qualify as a barrier? So we still have a lot of work cut out for us. But we did start the ball rolling, at least in raising the question, are we in the world of deraisa or world of rabbanan? Again, it's so important in sugyas and lamdas to always identify what world you're in. If you're in the deraisic world, you look at the sugya through a different set of lenses, then if you're in the rabbanan world. This may be an example of a scenario where we have machlekes rishonim, are we in the deraisa world or the derbanan world? So the Ritva we've identified, the Rambam we've identified. Hopefully, this year tomorrow we'll try to figure out what tells us his real opinion about this topic. I wish everybody a wonderful day.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you. Thank you. Be well.